This videotape is edited from an advanced NLP training in Boulder, Colorado, April 1989. Many of the participants had also attended previous advanced training with Richard. Richard considers this seminar to be his best ever presentation of how he works with clients. Although he presents some new submodality methods, his major emphasis is on how he puts things together and the methods that he uses to create lasting change. Since this is a carefully sequenced seminar, we recommend viewing the videotapes in order.
Did you come up with any other questions? Things that ramble through your mind? Things you want to know about, questions about this morning? Yes. Let's access auditorily.
You've been talking about how this is a through time.
Well, it's to build through time. That's why you do it. You time tunnel out into the future, yeah.
Time method. So I'm thinking about, do people not have attitudes if they don't do through time much?
It's not been my experience. No, they carry them differently. This is a way of installing them. It also does in time, in that you're collapsing it. In time, people have attitudes, but they fluctuate more. People who are through time have more consistent attitudes. Consistency is also something you will find on their hierarchy of criterion. That will be what they complain about in others. You know, they won't like that people change their mind and stuff like that, you know. Whereas in time people, could be one way or another. And especially if you pay attention to how they sort. Remember the metaprogram stuff from last time, the different sorting principles? Some people have different attitudes in different places, some with different people. And depending upon what criterion they sort by, you'll find that in time people switch radically from person to person and from place to place, depending upon how the sorting principle works. Through time, it won't be so much that way because when they sort, there'll be consistency between people. Even if they sort by people, they'll try to sort people to be the same so that they can, you know. You find this a lot in people, you know. If you really listen to them when they're talking about things that bother them, you know. It's like I find this a lot, you know, when I'd worked with couples, I'd find, you know, that these husbands would come in and complain that their wife isn't always the same. And I always look at them and I go, would you really want that? You know, and they go, well, only in certain things, you know. They want to mold people, and it's a tendency to, when you're searching for coherency, which is what metaprograms are about, is building coherency in your experience. It's how you sort the world out so that it builds coherency for you, so that it makes sense, because the world doesn't make sense, so you have to make sense out of it. And people who do external referential index checks on things have a tendency to try to get people to act certain ways to make their world coherent. Those are people who try to change your behavior a lot. You know. Is there more you wanted to know about that? Probably. When it crosses your mind, let me know. Any other questions about what we did this morning or anything else? Such a curious group. I think the altitude wipes your brains out or something.
Well, this is not about this morning, but it's
okay.
For me. I'd like to build a stronger internal sense of what is real, what really happened, so that it's just as you were saying.
What do you mean, what really happened?
Okay, in any, like the client that you talked about who came thinking that she'd been raped because the therapist had given her all the presuppositions. I want to be immune to that. I want to have a clearer
Don't
sense.
Don't go to therapy.
Right.
Next.
Have more of a trust in my own knowledge or my own sense of reality of what happened, and or to be able to go away and to say, well, we have a different perception on that and feel okay about it.
Yeah, you need to learn certain gestures. Like, those help a lot. You need to have more of an attitude. There's one thing about people that have heavy external references, which is that they're easily convinced of stuff for a while, right? I mean, but that you catch them between two people and they're like playing ping pong with them. I mean, I know of people that, you know, somebody tells them one thing and they believe and somebody tells them another. One of the things is to take the foundation of the things that you feel the strongest about, the things that you have absolutely no doubt about. And it's different than a beliefs because these are things about your experience. You know, that you pick of what you're most sure about happened in the past, the way you believe it happened, right? And notice the submodalities of it, right? And then tag it. See, for example, I had this schizo once, and I know I've probably written about it in books and stuff, but this schizo could not tell the difference between a constructed image and an eidetic image. They had no idea. I mean, you could say to this person, they had driven to out from Michigan to California, and the psychiatrist took her out of a back ward of a mental hospital and threw her in the back of the station wagon and brought her out. I love this, and brings her to a seminar. Right, too cheap to buy the session, right? So he goes to, brings her to a session, and doesn't tell anybody she's schizo. And we're doing all this constructed imagery stuff in the workshop, right? And so, of course, she just flipped, right? You know, you're making up all this change personal history. Perfect technique for her, huh? Right? And she does three or four change personal histories about the same thing with different people, and then she doesn't know what happened. And the thing is, so I sat down and I found out from the psychiatrist, I said, look, you know, the reference structure to know how to work with loonies. I mean, the guy works in a mental hospital, and you want to know how to work with a schizophrenic. If they're schizzy in a way you're not, then figure out how you do it. I mean, and install your strategy. It's better than nothing. You know, it may not be the best strategy, but it's better than somebody bouncing off of a rubber room. And with her, you know, I mean, literally I did things like I said, you know, I had her make up a fantasy of having flown to California. Then I said, did you fly or drive? And she went, I don't know. And I mean, this was like 3 minutes, you know, I just said, ran her through the guided fantasy and then asked. And she had the conflicting, she knew both, but she didn't know which one was real. She had no sense of what really had happened. So what I did is I had her put a border around constructed images so she would know those were constructed, you know, and did it with hypnosis, made it so that in dreams and everything, just put a black border around it. See one with a black border? It didn't really happen. See one that's panoramic? Know that it did. And so the thing is with your raw experience, you leave it panoramic. And then with things that are constructed images, especially that come from external voices, what you do is you give yourself a very distinct set of submodalities so that when people tell you what must have happened when you were a kid, you do it, you know, and you can always put a grain of salt in each corner just to help to remind you that other people's opinion of your life is just their opinion. And, you know, put a little internal voice that goes, no, maybe, you know, just to kind of remind you while they're talking, you know, and that kind of an internal auditory anchor along with a set of submodalities so that you can begin to sort out for yourself. So, like, you know, the thing that I would do would be to, like, take something that somebody told you, the kind of thing that you would believe too easily, and then take something that you know actually happened. You know where you had lunch today. You know, and if somebody tried to convince you you had something else for lunch other than you had, they probably have trouble doing that. Take those submodalities, add to it an auditory sound, and then have somebody literally give you a post-hypnotic suggestion that when other people tell you about your experience, to put it in that. See, one of the nice things about doing trance work, and I'm surprised at how little trance work people do, especially people who do therapy and counseling kinds of stuff, because you're always dealing with altered states. I mean, all the NLP techniques themselves are mini trances for the most part. I mean, you don't go in and do the phobia cure, you know, and change history, or a technique like we did this morning without going into a trance. And I mean, especially people like, you know, Gestalt therapy. Gestalt therapists insisted for years they didn't do hypnosis. They just had people hallucinate dead relatives on furniture and talk to it. And it talked back. I want you to think about that. I went to, I guess it was about 15, 16 years ago, I went to a Gestalt Institute in the Midwest. And they hired me to come in, you know, and I said, well, you know, you're all Gestalt therapists, so you all do hypnosis. And they got, like, insulted. And I said, wait a minute, that's a compliment, for God's sake. You know, this is one of the primary skills. Learning to deal with both people's conscious processes and their unconscious processes, I think, is an obligation. You know, I mean, especially for people who are in the business of sales. I mean, you're working primarily with unconscious processes. People don't know why they want things. They just do. And as long as that's the case, that's what you're working with. And also, when somebody makes a decision to buy something, you want them to congruently want it consciously and unconsciously and over time. You don't want no buyer's remorse. I figure that once somebody buys something from me, they've signed up for a job. Their job is to go out and prospect for me. And I mean, and I take that as a basic presupposition. How many people are business people here? I just hadn't asked that before. Doesn't that make sense to you? That, I mean, as soon as somebody, as I close any sale, to me, the only step left at that point, because I want to make sure every time they look at whatever they bought, they feel so powerfully good and delighted about what they do that they have to bring somebody else to buy something from me. And I wouldn't want to deprive them of the opportunity of sharing that good feeling with other people. Now, as long as I have that kind of a presupposition built in, I'm going to spend less and less time prospecting over the years and more time actually making money. Because, you know, prospecting is a time-consuming thing because you don't know exactly who wants things. So best you send your clients out to find out. When I was selling cars, I mean, to me, you know, I literally did a trance at the end of the closing. I mean, it's as deep a trance as the one I do at the end of workshops. You know, and as they sign the contract, I'd say, now, just I want you to close your eyes for a minute and feel good about what you've done. And to realize that right now with your eyes shut, you can't see your car. But in a minute, when you look at your car, you're going to become overwhelmed with such good feelings that you're going to want to share them with other people to realize that you've made the right decision and to realize who helped you to do that. And that you don't want other people to be ripped off by other salesmen. You want them to make the right decision too, don't you? Yes, I do. And I mean, to me, salesmen, they don't realize they're engaged in a hypnotic process. I mean, and people in advertising too, a lot of them don't realize. They're so worried about this thing about subliminal communication in commercials. I mean, to me, you know, they show other product, induce bad feelings. Show your product, induce good feelings. What do they think that is? That's hypnosis, man. It's nothing else. That's what they're up to. You might as well get pretty overt about it, you know. I mean, because there are hypnotic techniques. Because, like, when you're working with an individual, you can pace their breathing with your tempo. But when you work with an audience, whether it's on film or at large, you control their breathing through tempo fluctuations so that they can breathe only when you want them to. Now, the thing for me is to understand that the hypnotic process, for example, in my courses, a lot of what I have people do is to do wanted double inductions. For some reason, that's an easy place for people to start. And it also induces such severe trance that you get a chance to install good post-hypnotic suggestions like that. For me, the nice thing about hypnosis, too, that I really recommend that people spend time learning it, is that it's a good idea to discover how crazy a post-hypnotic suggestions you can give people. Because it does two things. One, it sensitizes you to the kind of shit you're saying. Because just because people don't have their eyes closed, they are in a trance, man. I mean, I want you to think about, you know, when my private practice, when I started, I was out in Ben Lomond in Santa Cruz, and people would drive over from the Silicon Valley. They had to drive through the redwoods, up this windy road through the trees and down this little road, you know. By the time they'd get there, the sun would be going down. It'd be dark, you know. They'd go out and hear wolves howling in the hills, you know. Walk in this little room with a complete maniac like me. You know, I had to assume they were going into an altered state. That, I mean, you know, you go sit out on the beach for a day and you go into an altered state. And when you go to a doctor, I mean, I've had clients that have had crazy stuff, you know, where doctors have induced in them. I had one guy that, you know, his ulcer kept getting worse and worse and worse, and they invented new medicine that pretty much clears up an ulcer. And they gave this guy the medicine, and it was like it would get better, but then it would get worse all of a sudden. As soon as he'd stop taking it, it would get worse, you know. And they started coming up, and they told him he had a metabolic difficulty, and that probably it would start affecting his blood pressure. And, I mean, they gave him all of these suggestions to the point where this guy was freaking out. And when he came to me, he came just to learn relaxation. And so I put him in a deep trance, and then I set up finger signals with him, because I knew he'd been to a doctor. I said, did your doctor give you any suggestions that this sort of stuff would happen? I get a yes, and I said, and have you, his unconscious, been carrying out these suggestions for no reason? I get, yes, I have. I go, would you prefer to stop? Yes, I would. Stop. You know, have you stopped? Yes, I have. Right? And then he was fine. I mean, you know, got to understand when people are scared for their health or when they're dealing, of course, even if you have somebody with a phobia, you bring them in, you have to think about their phobia. Fear is an incredibly altered state. I mean, you can give really wanton suggestions. I was talking earlier to somebody about using the visual squash, that when you set up, you know, when people, the people that come in that have had so much therapy, they got a million parts, you know. I mean, me, I just try to integrate them, stuff them all into one and shove it inside them. And I do things like have them spread them out and look at them all and then just literally physically crush them into one thing. And then as soon as they get them crushed together, they like shove them inside their chest. And when they do, they go, when you get that, I start firing off post-hypnotic suggestions like crazy. Because when I see radical shifts in people that look like trance inductions, the same thing you see, you know, you guys done the handshake interrupt? Most of you in here? Is that yes or? This is an interesting combination. We get a few yeses and a few noes. Well, the handshake interrupt, when you do it, the one nice thing about it when you learn to do it is to watch the expression on their face. Because you're going to see that anyway. And when you see it, just start firing off suggestions. You know, you will enjoy life more. And it's kind of like, did you ever see that Saturday Night Live skit where the guy worked for the Center for Subliminal Communication?
Yes.
Right? You guys ever see that? And he walks into his boss and he goes, "Hi, how are you? Give me a raise today." Right? And he kept embedding these verbal things. Well, it's a little bit like that, but you catch these moments because when you're working with people, when you're having them go inside and access things and come out, when you look at them, if you know what trance looks like, you're going to be able to recognize it. And when you recognize it, throw out suggestions. It's the same thing as the one thing I always do throughout sessions is I stack post-hypnotic suggestion on post-hypnotic suggestion and presupposition on presupposition because it doesn't hurt. You know, since you want everything you do. Because the one reason I'm so conscious of it is that if you're not deliberately doing it in a way that's useful, you most likely will be doing it in a way that's not useful. I mean, when I get done working with a phobic, I'll look at them and I'll say, now think about your phobia and try to have as much fear as you can in vain. Now, I mean, that's a pretty loaded suggestion. Try in vain to have the same old feelings. I mean, it pretty much sets you up for success. But, you know, if somebody says, now I want you to go back and re-experience all that fear fully, right? Well, it's a suggestion. You may have cured their phobia, but you can reinduce it. I mean, I can take anybody whose phobia has been cured and give them a new one. I mean, if you can take them away, you can give them back. And the trick is to make sure you so pad your work that the inherently helpful people that surround an individual don't do it. Because imagine, hey, I took a course from the guy that had the theory of inherently helpful people. I'm serious about this. This guy had a theory and a government grant and everything. And he did a research study, and this is how he got his PhD, and proved that it had nothing to do with what you did as a therapist or as a clinician, that some people were inherently helpful and others weren't. You are genetically a good therapist or you are not. And he had all the characteristics of what an inherently helpful person was like. Of course, they seemed a lot like him. It was the same as Maslow's authenticated person. It was a description of Maslow, right? Because, I mean, Maslow is kind of the visionary of modern psychology. I mean, you know, the authenticated person was somebody that liked to be alone and read and sit in their office. Kind of like Maslow, you know? And it was so, you know, and, you know, there was the person who was the transparent self and then the one that was, I guess, the translucent self or the opaque self or whatever that shit was. I don't know. It was all real confusing to me. It was just all that sounded like was Maslow. If you are like me, you are authenticated. If not, you are not real. You are not your real self. If you were real self, you'd be me. I mean, you know. When I took this in college, you know, and I asked this guy, I said, you really believe being able to help people is genetic? You know, and this guy looked me straight in the eye, and he said, yeah. And I said, well, maybe you could help me with this. And the guy said, I don't think so. Because I'm not an inherently helpful person. But I am pretty good at changing people. And one of the reasons is that I mean, I always think about and take into consideration that you're not just working in your session. That all that stuff, you know, about, like Virginia Satir talked about family systems, you know, you fix a schizophrenic, put them back in the family, they get skitsy again. Well, you have to deal with not just the family, but all the inherently helpful people that are surrounding somebody's life. I mean, it's like, I worked with somebody one time that had an escalator phobia. And when I was done, of course, I want to test my work. And so I had to meet me in a hotel that had this really neat set of escalators that went up three floors. You know, it's a big hotel in Seattle. And it's the Washington Plaza Hotel. And it's got, and I like it because it has the big teeth on the end. You know, because I always do that. When you want to scare your phobics, you have them look down at the escalator and turn the things on there into teeth. Right? And then you put lips on them and shut them. Turn them into a kiss. You know. That always confuses them. I go, everybody has teeth, including the people you love. I said, you kiss your wife, don't you? Well, of course I do. Well, look at the elevator and feel this. It's like your wife. But only for kissing. So anyway, I take this guy out after I work with him, and we go down the elevator, and he was fine. Elevators were no problem. And we walk around, and I didn't realize, but he had his family wait in the lobby. And he had his wife, and he had his two sons, and something. And they were going to go out to dinner or something afterwards, and they were sitting in the lobby. And I walk this guy around to the escalator, and they all jumped up with panic on their faces as I led him up to the thing. Now, I was lucky you didn't see him. I saw him, and I freaked out. Right? I was like, don't go on there. It's broken, you know. And the guy goes, what's the matter? It's okay. But, I mean, the thing is that if he has to move through the world with everybody analogically reacting as if he has the same problem, all of those things are going to be anchors. They are the anchors that maintained his problem in the first place. So if everybody acts as if you are the same and generates nonverbal and verbal cues to that effect, then what happens is this is one of the things that you're up against. Now, if you remember on the blackboard yesterday, remember I put up that thing about wiping out cues? This is the next step. The next step is to be able to go through and to literally wipe out the kind of cues that are going to occur. And I find the best place to do this is in an altered state. Because the nice thing is when you induce a deep, mellow, wonderfully pleasant altered state and then review the situation, it has the same trick that the phobia cure has built into it. See, the phobia cure isn't related to phobias. Most people don't realize that. It has nothing to do with phobias. It has to do with the fact that you're looking at whatever you're phobic of or listening to whatever you're phobic of and feeling fine. That's all. That's the only thing that it does. Disassociation is just a trick to get you there. It's not the only way to get you there either. It happens to be an easy one. So if somebody has a phobia of roller coasters, if they see what they'd see in a front seat of a roller coaster and hear the sound, well, they feel phobic. But if you have them watching themselves on a roller coaster, well, they still hear the same sounds. They're still seeing a roller coaster, but you've now reduced the visual stimulus. When you disassociate them again, the sound is still there, and they're still seeing the same thing. There still is a roller coaster. Because people who have a phobia of roller coasters can't even think about one, let alone go on one. But already, to them, it makes sense. And they're sitting there calmly watching a roller coaster, which means now the sound of a roller coaster is an anchor for the altered state in which they're calm. Now, the same thing is true. Now, if you want to go through and wipe out large numbers of cues, and the trick is, since you don't know what they are, the best way is as soon as you've done, like if we take the change that you made here, and the next step now is to be able to induce an altered state. And I found out, I guess I didn't teach it. There was an induction that I always liked, and I asked somebody in here, and they told me I didn't teach it. I didn't teach you guys before the induction where you lift one hand as slowly as humanly possible. That was the second trick. This is the trouble with you guys not doing all four. Well, anyway, I'm going to have you try an induction. And for those of you who haven't done any hypnosis, don't worry about it because you can't do hypnosis wrong. People either go into a trance or they don't. But what we're going to do is we're going to make it a little easier this time, because what we're going to do is I want you to just simply realize that what you do is you breathe at the same rate, you make your voice tone and your voice tempo smooth and even so that it paces their breathing, so that as they breathe in and breathe out, you take your tone and you literally take the tone and shift it up and down with their breathing. And then you can take your voice tone and go lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. And listen carefully while you do so. Because now the other thing is to remember all of the things that you've learned about language, because this is where the art form comes. Linkage, as, while, so that each thing links to the next thing. Now, what I want you to do is to tell them to sit there, put their hands on their legs, on their thighs, take a deep breath. Now, why do you tell them to take a deep breath? So that you can see where they breathe. You got to remember, you do stuff for yourself. Some of you who have been too inherently helpful forget that what you do is you make calibration easy for yourself. Instead of trying to see subtle nonverbal cues that force you to squint like this, I've seen so many people who have spent, I had some people who went through a 27-day training down in Houston, and they spent 3 weeks, 21 days, learning calibration. And they were the most blind, deaf, dumb people I'd met, because all they were trying to calibrate to was minimal stuff. So they missed all the big things, right? And I mean, to me, the thing is if you can't see it, exaggerate it in the person to make it easy for you, because it'll be more useful that way anyway. It's nice to be able to see subtle nonverbal stuff, but not if you miss the big stuff. Start with the big stuff and work your way down. So you have them take a deep breath that shows you where they breathe. And as they let that breath out, you begin to talk. And you tell them, take a deep breath. And as you do so, relax. Because as they breathe out, it's going to relax. That's automatic built-in pacing. Take another deep breath. And as you let this one relax, close your eyes. And very slowly begin to lift one hand as slowly as is humanly possible. And while you do so, begin to make images of past pleasant memories, things you can enjoy from your childhood. And while you enjoy those things from your childhood, I want you to find one that's a pleasant past memory, one you can enjoy fully. And then very slowly, what I want you to do as that hand continues to lift up is to realize in a moment I'm going to reach over and lift up your other arm. Now, what you do is you then reach over and lift up either arm, because the other one will be the one that's lifting. If it's already off, lift up the other one. Okay? Now, once you've lifted up your arm, what you do is you lift it up so it's even, and you tell them, I'm not going to tell you to put it down any faster than what you begin to do is to make certain shifts, because I want you to make an image of the most relaxing, pleasant past memory you can find. Staring at a fire, watching the water glisten across a lake, any pleasant memory. And then very slowly, I want you to push that image away from you and make it larger. So that you begin to take, because trance is stuff that's not normal consciousness, right? Altered state. So what you do is go through and start taking pairs of submodalities and moving them in incongruent fashions. In other words, if consciously, when you drive away from a mountain, it gets what? So you have them get further away from something and make it bigger, right? You have a sound get further away and get what? Or get closer and get right. So that what you do is you begin to build incongruencies. And what you do is you tell them, as you suggest each one of these, if it helps them to relax and go deeper and deeper and deeper into a deep trance, that what you want them to do is to allow their hand to float up a little bit more. And if they begin to feel like they're floating up out of a trance, allow their hand to go down. So that what you do is you then have a pretty good piece of calibration. Their hand goes up, they're going deeper. Their hand goes down, they're not. In either case, you already have arm catalepsy, so they're going deeper anyway, whether they know it or not. Now, as you begin to induce the trance, what I want you to do is to watch their face, watch their breathing, and as they appear to be going deeper, lower the tone of your voice. If they appear to be coming up a little bit, raise your voice tone up, and then just keep lowering your voice down. Lower and lower, softer and softer, quieter and quieter, so that as you begin to speak to them in a way that they can relax fully and listen and understand each and every word, then you begin to suggest to them that what they're going to do is to take the new learning, the new understanding, which they just made this morning, a change that builds in a new belief and a new attitude, and now what they're going to do is move back through time. Because here's where the past becomes a valuable ally. And you have them float back above their timeline, back when they were younger, and take the new belief and the new feeling with them, and literally slowly move right up through times, bits and places, where they'd had a lack of these qualities of the past, and feel, that's the magic word, how they would have done it different. Not see, feel how they would have done it different. See what freedom it would have allowed them, and enjoy fully the magnitude of the freedom and the release of energy and the creativity and the productivity that this will mean in the future, such that when they reach the present time, they can explode into the future with enthusiastic and vigorous and delightful enthusiasm at the changes that they're going to have, lasting and lasting and lasting. Again, stacking presuppositions. Not lasted, lasting. That is, ing words go out into the future. I am looking for something. I am going somewhere. So as you get to the present and go into the future, you begin to use lots of ing words so that you propel them into the future with utter and wanton enthusiasm. Did you have a question? Now? I'm sure this is all clear in your mind. As it gets clearing up more and more, it'll give you an opportunity to begin to calibrate. Now, if you want to join pairs so you could do double inductions on one another, that's fine for those of you that know how. The deeper you induce the trance, the more you'll be able to smooth out the semantic response in the past. Because now, the one thing you do want to do with your partner is remember you have a very powerful anchor that you made, right? Because you remember yesterday I told you when you collapsed the things together to anchor it? You guys remember yesterday, right? Some people didn't do it. So today, you all remembered to do it, right? Oops! It's the major thing I think people have an internal dialogue when there's more, you know, because, you know, Miller and Glanner always said the limits of human memory was 7 ± 2, you know. Bullshit, it's 1 ± 2. And a lot of times it's just -2 + nothing. That's right. You got to remember these things, and the best way to remember them is if you should forget, notice that you've forgotten, go back and do it again. And when you get tired of doing it again, then you'll remind yourself. Some of you take notes, but then you don't read them. Okay. So you have a powerful anchor, which is for the thing that has the three beliefs and the new attitude together. You've now collapsed three sets of submodalities. So you want to go back, and you want to induce as pleasant a state. Now, I'll show you a little trick about inducing pleasant states. That when you've induced in them the altered state, and you have them go back and find something serene, pleasant memory, tell them, because trance is the most powerful amplifier, tell them to literally double the intensity of their enjoyment. Because the most unconscious process, and we were talking about this today, the most unconscious thing people do, other than speak language, is multiply. People do not multiply consciously. It's a trance phenomenon. That's how people do math. That's why people that don't do math well, that's because they try to do it with their conscious mind. Conscious minds are not qualified to do multiplication. This is one of the reasons they have so much trouble teaching multiplication and division in school, is it is a straight trance phenomenon. And I was telling Michael that when Milton Erickson did time distortion experiments, for those, any of you read his book, Time Distortion, in here? It's always nice to be well-read in your field. Anyway, he has a book called Time Distortion, which he did all kinds of time distortion exercises. And if he held real time constant, people could double, triple, and quadruple the amount of output. He took a dress designer. She could design 5 dresses in trance time and come out and draw them all down. And she could do this, but the one thing he could not get people to do faster in time distortion was multiplication. They could not multiply more numbers in time distortion than they could in the waking state. And he was always terribly confused about this. But since it's already a time distortion phenomenon, somebody says to you, like, what's 7 × 6? What? Right? Boom. You don't know how you did it, do you? You go into a little time distortion state, and you're out of it. Because the way they teach you to do this stuff, they teach you to go through a whole list of it and find the one that fits. You know, that some of you were done visually with a chart. Some of you learned it through auditory repetition. And when somebody asks you the question, you go zzz, poof, and give them the output. So you're already doing time distortion, so of course you cannot increase the number. But multiplication also, you multiply trance states. Notice how deep you are, ×2. ×4. More reasons than you realize it will be useful for you. Scope ambiguity is a wonderful thing, is it not? Now, useful for you to begin to consciously understand what I'm saying. Now, so we don't want to lose anyone here. After lunch. After lunch, yeah. It's always nice to do a little trance work after lunch. Helps the digestion, you know. Now, The thing is, so one of the other tricks is you can multiply the depth of trance, but you can also multiply the intensity of feelings so that you take the good feelings that they have from the changes they made. Multiply the depth of trance. Say, like, one of the things I like to do is I like to say, like, for example, you can feel yourself float down one notch at a time, you know, and do it like this and go one, two, three, four times two. That has no impact. I always love it when people are holding on to the side of chairs in seminars. I'm not going into a trance. Deeply and thoroughly and enjoyably, with a sense of wanton pleasure and anticipation, times two, for many reasons, after you ate lunch. I love brains. They're such great toys. Now, the thing is that once you get them into the altered state, you will remember to take the person back, take the new learnings they just built, the new attitude, and smooth through their personal history by having them go through and feel how much easier it would have been to have this attitude, how much more enjoyable, and see what freedom it would have given them. And then propel themselves out in the future with twice to four times as much good feeling and sense of want and anticipation about how this is going to permeate their life. Because this is where you get to give suggestions about generalization. Now, I'm sure this is all clear to each of both of you. Your unconscious can assist you in this process, and you can enjoy the process of learning with both minds. So now, go find your partner, take about 20 minutes apiece, and rock and roll your way through it, and pay careful attention to your tonality, your anchoring. Remember, it's okay to go into a trance when you're doing trance work with people, as long as you can still talk and see. I remember when I taught the handshake interrupt, and two people walked up, and they didn't get clear who was going to do it to who, and they both did this, and they stood there like this. I walked over, and there were two people like this on the side of the room, and I went, "Hello! One at a time!" Okay, go for it, and enjoy the process. And remember, the best thing to do is to make trance enjoyable, pleasurable, and fun, because that way people will learn much more from it. Robert's a real doer, but there's some things that, you know, he's just too awkward to do. He's Robert, you know. And so he always wants me to do them because he loves to watch me do super deep trance inductions, rapid ones and stuff. So he talks to this guy, and this guy's got all these vision problems and stuff. So he tells this guy, as I'm sitting in the front row, and we're supposed to be co-teaching, right? And he draws this stuff on the blackboard and has the guy try to read it. And the guy can't even read it with his glasses on. And the letters are like this big. The guy's blind as a fucking bat, you know. And so Robert says, well, you know, he says, we'll do something with him. And then he signals the guy, says, come on up. And as he turns over, he looks at me and he goes like this. He just over his shoulder goes, put him in a deep trance. Like this, right? And I, of course, you know, I don't hear that well because I'm not paying attention. I went, what? And then it just kind of rolled back through. And he goes, you haven't really met my friend Richard. He said, I'd like to introduce you. He goes, Richard, like this. And Robert does a handshake gesture like, you know, would you like to meet my friend Richard? So this kid walks up on the stage like this to me. And I thought, Robert, set me up, man. So I whacked this guy into a deep trance, right? Just zone him through the floor, right? And then I had him come out of trance and I left his arm in trance. Told him his arm would stay in trance and he would come out. So the guy comes out and he's like this, you know, and I said, in a moment, I'm going to reach over and touch you on the nose. Your conscious mind is going to go totally away so that I can speak privately with your unconscious mind. And the guy goes, huh. And I said, you don't believe that. And he went, no. And I said, let's ask your unconscious mind. Does it believe it? And his hand goes like this. And I said, is there anything he can do that will stop it? And it goes like this. And then I reach over and I go like this, and as he starts moving his hand back like this, like that, and it's like till he can't go any further. And when I did it, the guy just slopped down in the chair. So then I did this stuff where I age regressed and made his eyes better and did all this stuff, and bring him out, and without his glasses, put him back in the front row. He could read everything but the word emotional. He couldn't read the word emotional. He could read every other word, but he couldn't read the word emotional. The guy was just, you know, well, a lot of people, you know, he obviously, you know, had gone, a lot of people blur their eyes out as a way of dealing with stress. And you can always identify them because the minute stress occurs, they take their glasses off. You know, if you make things tense in the room, they take their glasses off immediately. And those are people you can fix their eyes just like that. And the thing about hypnosis, the one thing is that, I mean, you know, if you make a mistake, you can always fix it. Because one thing I like about hypnosis is it's so overt, it's obvious. But you have to respond that people respond so literally that you can't give suggestions by conversational postulate. You can't assume that people mean what you say. You have to really say, you have to be very exact with language. And actually, it's true in the conscious state, but it's less obvious in some ways. One of the reasons I like people to spend a lot of time doing hypnosis is because there's always these quirky things that happen that teach you to be more precise about your language. I mean, funny kinds of stuff. Because I had a client when I was first learning hypnosis, and I told this guy that, and I mean, I just knew what was on my mind. I told this guy I was going to count from 20 to 1 and that he would come all the way out trance. And for some reason, something interrupted me or something. I went back and I counted from 10 to 1, and the guy just didn't come out, right? You know, I counted, and I could tell as I was counting, nothing was happening, right? And I stopped, and I thought, well, you know, maybe they can get stuck, you know, right? And finally, you know, like this, you know, and I said, is there anything that stops you from coming out of trance? And I get this yes signal, right? You know, what is it? And he went like this. He went, right, and I went, oh, 20, yeah, 20, I remember. You know, it's always nice. You can always get them to help you out a little bit, but I thought that was a great finger signal. Wrong number. You said 20. Oh, okay, yeah, anything you say, man. And one time we did this trance work with this guy in Palo Alto. He was some guy that ran a clinic, and he hired us to train his staff and then pretended to be a client, like we didn't know who he was. But we knew who he was. And I tried to tell him ahead of time. He was trying to pretend to be a client. And I said, do you want to pretend to be a client? I was real, you know, it's like I know who you are, right? And the guy wouldn't break his role. It's like if he kept pretending, I'd forget or something, right? So I figured if this guy's going to be a jerk, you know, I'll use hypnosis because there is no pretend in hypnosis, you know, because he was one of a lot of therapists role play, you know, that's role playing stuff. Well, you don't role play being in a deep trance, you know. So I figured, you know, I'd go straight for the thing. So I just, you know, whacked this guy into a deep trance, you know, and did the work with him. And it was amazing afterwards. He told me, gee whiz, those problems are actually things that occur in his life. Big surprise. But I decided at the end, you know, as long as he was being a prick about it, that I'd give him a suggestion. So I gave him for a suggestion that he would go for a walk in downtown Palo Alto, right? But I didn't give him the suggestion he would come back. Right, so it ended up backfiring on me because while I'm waiting with the rest of the staff and they're all getting nervous because I don't know where the hell this guy is. Suddenly, it dawned on me the suggestion I gave him. I suddenly like played it back in my head and I realized I'd given him suggestion to go for a walk. And conversationally, that means you go for one and it ends, right? But when you give it to somebody in a trance, so we had to go out and roam the streets, you know. And I found him; he was halfway to Menlo Atherton, you know. So it's dun da 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 da, you know, and it's like, what are you doing? I'm walking, you know. You can stop now. Oh, thank you, you know. You get some really funny stuff, and I mean, but I mean, it happens the other way around because a lot of people don't realize that one of the reasons that you always want to have a sense of humor, no matter how grim people's problems are, is you do not want to reinforce their problems. Like, you know, I mean, I've heard some of the most bizarre stuff that when people, you know, describe something bad that happened to them, they go, that must terrify you to even think about it. You know, it's like, ah, now that you mention it, you know, and it's like, you know, and I've heard people say, well, you know, do you relive this phenomenon over and over again every night in your dreams? And I know they're trying to be helpful. They don't realize they're giving embedded commands, and embedded commands do work. And the nice thing about using trance work and making sure you end your sessions with a trance that goes back and smooths out the past and really projects people in the future is that if you've screwed up at all in the middle, you're going to fix it. And it's, you know, because you can't be perfect and you can't expect yourself to be perfect. So you build in little safeguards to try and make sure that you'd, as it said in one of the brochures, the first workshop I did up in Seattle was for a family therapy institute. And they didn't know what I did, and they kept talking to people and reading some of the stupid magazine interviews and stuff. And they really didn't know what to put in their brochure copy. And they put, you know, Richard Bandler and John Grinner are going to help us to get out of our own way. while we're working with other clients so we don't hurt them anymore. You know? And it was so good I had to clip it out and put it on the wall. You know. And when we went in to do the workshop, I was surprised that this brochure got like 200 people, right? You know. And I asked people, I said, are you here to find out how to not hurt your clients anymore? Said, oh, yeah, yeah. Do you know that you are? No. But we must be. You know. If you say we are, Rich, we are. Well, good. Stop it. That, I mean, to me, one of the nice things about learning, because see, when you learn to utilize timelines, it allows you to be able to do all kinds of things to reduce semantic response and to increase semantic response. Because to me, like, one of the things that I've discovered is that the focus that people have on their unpleasant parts of their life, the fact that they're so focused on it, it's like, how many of you, do any of you do body work in here? Do you have people that do any kind of body work? Have you ever noticed this thing that, you know, you take somebody who hasn't been able to move their arm in 3 years, right? You give them back mobility of their arm, right? You know, their left side of their body was paralyzed. You know, I'll spend 3 hours and make it so they can move it again, right? And do you know what they say to me? Instead of something like, thank you, right? They say, well, if, you know, if I move it like this, it still hurts. You know, and I go, well, don't move it like that, you know? But the thing is they're so aimed at searching for pain that the whole grid is still aimed that way. Well, the same thing happens when people have problems in their life. If they have a phobia of something, they'll go, it's better, but I can still feel this little tingle right here. You ever cured a phobia and get this shit? You know, it's like that. And I go, well, gee, that's too bad. Maybe we should put the whole thing back. That always shuts them right up, let me tell you. I go, I'll install it, make it twice as bad as it was. That'll get rid of the tingle. And they go, no, they're going to keep the tingle. But the thing is that they're so aimed at looking for if there's still any fear left, if there's still any discomfort, if they still feel threatened by a situation, you know, or if they still have, you know, well, if I think about it, you know, I still feel a little tightness up here, you know, or I still feel a little tight, you know. These are people that couldn't even do it, you know. You take somebody who's an agoraphobic, you get them on the outside, and you go, how is this? And they go, instead of going, well, I feel free and enriched, you know, I have my life back, they go, well, I still feel a little tight down here. And I go, well, go back to your room, you know. Wait another 10 years. And, you know, and the thing is if I can't interject humor at those points to the point where I can get them to laugh about it, that it seems so real to them, you know, because they focus so much attention on it that one of the things you have to do is literally switch perceptual grids, which is the third thing I put on the board yesterday. Because, I mean, we've now covered two of them, and for me, learning to switch perceptual grids is an important thing. Because when people are trying to solve a problem, to begin with, they're operating out of the framework that something is wrong. Now, even though their problem works perfectly, I mean, even schizophrenics, like Andy worked perfectly as a schizophrenic. I mean, Andy wasn't schizzy one day, and it, you know, there was five or six triggers that set him off, and there's a myriad of things that if it was up to me would be what he would need, but he certainly didn't need to flip out because somebody had long hair. I mean, this is not profoundly useful. I mean, even in the third session, when I asked Andy, and I loved it when I said, you know, this sounds like a lot of work, right? I said, between your house and the bank, how many of these episodes do you have to have? And he stops, and he thinks about it, and he goes, well, about eight. And it was eight per block or something like that. And whatever it was, you know, I said, God, you know, and they don't even pay you for this, you know. And he's going, yeah, you know, this is really a problem. Because part of what I was doing was switching his framework to the fact that it was a job to maintain it. I wanted him to have his problem seem like work rather than something that he responded to. I wanted him to, number one, know that he was doing it, to respond out of the attitude that instead of this is something that happens to him, it's something he's doing voluntarily, and it's something he should be paid for, that it is an accomplishment, and it's a pain in the ass. It's a lot of work to have 8 psychotic episodes per block, you know, and they're not even paying for you, just trying to go to the bank and cash a check, and just because the bank happens to be 2 blocks away, you have to have 16 psychotic episodes. I mean, that's, you know, that's a lot of work, you know. And he was going, God, if you only knew, you know. He said, you have no idea how much trouble this is. I said, you know, not to mention the fact if a long-haired guy comes along, or there's a dog, or one of these things, I said, you could spend a whole day going to the bank, you know, go through all this pain, all this stress, all this freaking out, and who pays you for it? Nobody. What a ripoff. Now, part of the thing that I'm doing inside of the thing that I think is really important for people, especially if you're going to work with individuals. And, I mean, I use this especially when I do management training, because managers, a lot of them get geared into looking for what's wrong rather than filling people with doing things right. See, for example, if they noticed who does what well and have them do that more and have somebody else do the other parts, part of the responsibility of being able to delegate authority is to know to whom. That's one of the things that I find that managers don't pay attention to. They keep giving people the wrong tasks and then blaming them for not doing them. You know, you take somebody who can't spell and have them copy at it, it shouldn't be their ass that's kicked. You know, it's yours. You either teach them to spell or you have somebody else do it. I mean, this is part of what makes businesses operate efficiently as teams, is that you utilize people's skill. You don't have them do things they're not good at because it's their job description. You switch their job description and give somebody else that part of the job so that you get things done and make money. I mean, that's the purpose of having businesses. It's not a hobby with most of us. We have businesses because we like cash and because it gives us the opportunity to do what we like. Now, it's not a question of whether somebody likes a task or not. It's a question of whether they do it good, because it's easy to get people to enjoy things. It's harder to get them to be good at it. And so if you have somebody that's already good at it, it's better utilization. Either that or you have to motivate them to want to become good at it, because people don't learn to spell overnight. You can give them a spelling strategy, but they still have to learn words. Also, one of the problems with it is that if they learn the words off of stuff they've already written, they'll learn to spell them wrong. You've got to make sure they do it with a dictionary and not with their own writing, or worse, from somebody else's writing who doesn't spell well. Now, in terms of switching perpetual grids, it's like when I do body work with people for the first couple of years, I got pissed at them for this. I thought, you fucking ungrateful assholes. I mean, I worked with a guy that rolled a motorcycle 130 miles an hour, and they had to reconstruct his shoulder, and they did a terrible job of it. It's one of the worst jobs I've ever seen. It looked like it was put together by a motorcycle mechanic who wasn't good at chopping Harleys. You know, he only did dirt bikes. And what happened was, is 3 years later, this shoulder didn't hurt, but the other side of his body got so screwed up, he couldn't move his arm and leg without it hurting excruciatingly. His spine literally went like this, and so all the ribs on this side were unattenuated and twisted. So if he moved, when ribs on the back, by the way, aren't attached, they attenuate. They're like a press fit. They just kind of slide in there. So if your spine curves and this twists out, you have little sharp points that poke you in the muscles, and they hurt, having a twisted rib. So he had all of this stuff was screwed up because the way they stuck the pin in arced his spine over. So I took this guy, and I mean, this guy was in pain. He was taking pain pills all day long, doing all this shit, couldn't work, stuff. So I take this guy, and with the person I did body work at the time, a lady named Glenda, we did a 3-hour marathon session on this guy to find out if we could straighten his spine out, because he also had something called scoliosis, which is supposed to be irreparable. So we fixed it. You know, it's a weird thing. They claim you can't fix this, but if they hang you upside down, you don't have it. Isn't that weird? It's a certain kind of curvature of the spine. And they claim you cannot fix this, but if you hang somebody upside down, they don't have it. They only have it one way in relationship to gravity. So either you put roller skates on their head or you fix it. We decided fixing it probably seemed a little more practical. But when we fixed this guy, when I was done, right, we sent him home and we told him, look, just relax for the evening, you know, and take it easy for the next couple of days and give us a call. Well, the guy calls the next day, right, and goes, I'm in excruciating pain. And I said, well, did you do anything after you left yesterday? And he said, well, I went home and split a cord of wood. And I thought, you son of a bitch. And I said, why did you do that? And he said, because I wanted to see if I could make it hurt. And I said, do you want it to hurt? And he said, no, but if I don't push it up against the pain, I won't know if it's going to hurt. Well, this is somebody that paid attention to too many of these commercials for people who sell exercise equipment. You ever notice that they try to teach you that, you know, no pain, no gain?
Bullfuck.
You know, I know a lot of top athletes that, you know, weightlifters, professionals, and they don't do it till it hurts. Thing is that in order for me, then I started discovering that the kind of grid these people had was the same thing that I found when I worked with people. If they were just working with somebody who was shy, instead of looking at how much further they got and how much further that meant that they could go, they would literally be going out to try and find a situation in which they felt shy or how little shy. It was to them then a degree. They didn't think about how much less shy they were. It was, well, there's still a little bit left. Now, I'm sure you've heard this kind of stuff. So one of the things that I started to do is to build perceptual grids while I've got them in trance. Because what I want to do is to refocus their attention so that if they notice any change, that as they look, they're going to find that they change more and more each day. So one of the things that I do is the next little piece that I want you to add on to what you did, just as a taste, is I begin to set up an old thing that in sales, they call it, it's the Ben Franklin technique. It's the either or, right? It's which weighs more, which do you want more? So I begin to describe that, and this is actually a lie, but I'm always willing to lie to my clients, as long as they get where they want to go. But it's not really a lie because it kind of works. I talk about how if you pay attention to the unpleasant parts of your life, you notice them. And I have them think about how much energy they spent noticing about the problem that they have had. This is a perfect place to begin to slam in massive presuppositions and massive post-hypnotic suggestions. This is where you want to get into past tense predicates, because they are very, very powerful. That if they noticed the problem that they had, that it was so all-consuming, the amount of their energy and attention that they spent looking at how bad they felt, made it so that they felt worse. That's why problems get worse. And even now, no matter how much better they feel, or if they totally have changed now, if they go looking to feel bad, they will. So now they come to a choice point, a decision in their life, a focal point. And this is the point at which I use all my tonality and all my direction to make it sound as if they are on the precipice of life. Either they can make the rest of their life shit, or they can make the rest of their life ecstasy. Now, as I go through this induction, what I set up is, I set up, in essence, a scale. But the scale is not just a verbal one. I do it kinesthetically as well. And I use anchors, because I set up an anchor for unpleasantness, particularly whatever the unpleasantness they had. For example, in the thing we were using today, hesitating, being wussy. Now, as you took them and slowed time down till it hit critical mass, if you then review it, if you go back and you go, if you remember how it felt as you watched time go by slowly so that you got to spend every moment of every waking day with the client that was the most problem, as you watch and you realize and then you say, if you remember how bad that felt, and you can think about if you want to focus on that over and over again for years to come. No, no, please, Richard. I think we should stop here. Right. Let's see, because we could leave it like that. Or on the other knee, I mean hemisphere. I also want to be able to anchor noticing how much better and how much freer life is. So that by the same token, I'm going to go on the other hemisphere and I'm going to say, but you can also think that when you came in and you thought about your problem, it overwhelmed you. When you think about it now and it doesn't, how much freer you are, how much human energy you have, energy that could be used for passion, for orgasms. And if you're looking for passion, orgasms, lust, wealth, and excitement, you have that choice. So that you can either take your attention and you can focus it here, or you can focus it here. Now, which do you want? Where is your attention going to be as you close your eyes now and look out into the future? As you step and look down your timeline, which are you going to take with you? As you walk through each moment and each session, which are you going to find you're doing with your clients? How are you programming their future? What are you getting them to pay attention to? What do you listen and hear in what they say that tells you what you can do with them? Because you get what you give to other people. What are you going to add to the other people's in your lives? What are you going to comment about your relationships with other people? Are you going to tell them about the parts of their experience that you don't like? Are you going to tell them what you do like and expand and increase the amount of time and attention you spend doing that? It's up to you which you want to feel. And notice which you have a tendency to go towards with a compelling and overwhelming sense of direction. Because as you look out your timeline, begin to move one day at a time forward. And each day that you pay attention to this, it will become stronger. And keep moving one day, another day, then a week ahead, and then a month, and then a year. And notice how you can multiply what you pay attention to. Can you feel this would be useful now? Whoopee! Ain't nothing like sitting in that chair in the front row. That's right. And keep moving forward down that timeline and make a firm and solid commitment. And then what you do is I want you to step away and look at what kind of a future you plan for yourself. Does it glow and glitter around your timeline? Is it a positive future that you're going to have? And then slide back into your present, and as you do so, feel something lock into place. A good feeling, perhaps, that you want to keep. And always look to see how much of that good feeling you're getting. And take the most convincing voice in your head and hear it from every direction. Ask the question, how much am I enjoying this? How much pleasure am I finding here? How good is this? How can I make it more fun? And hear it resonate through your head, both sides, and resonate. And every time you begin to miss the point of living, that voice will ask you that question. How much more fun could I be having? How much better can it get? And as you keep that voice in lock in your head, your unconscious mind can and will confirm that you will make this a way of life that you can and will enjoy. Utterly and completely, with a growing sense of wanton anticipation. And as you do so, take a deep breath and begin to feel a good feeling start to spread throughout your body. That's right. Start to tingle all around. Start to light up your life. Start to put wanton fantasies of just what you can do into your mind. So that slowly, as you return back to the waking state, that commitment becomes locked firm and solid. And the firmer and solid it's locked, the more you can get to the waking state, and the more your body will feel wonderful. Now, that's just a suggestion you will carry out and follow. Utterly and completely. Now, this is the kind of subtle stuff that I'm trying to get you guys to do. Right? It's none of this sitting around and going, and how do you feel about that? You know, I mean, or going into a meeting and going, well, do you see any good prospects for the future? Fuck that. Jam them in their head. You know, if I want people work for me to have a positive view of the future, I'm going to take it and put it on a brick and shove it right in their skull so they don't miss it. I sort of the sledgehammer approach to things, that everything that you do by stacking and reinforcing and putting positive feelings with it, putting positive stuff, begins to build a grid. See what I mean, Robert? Of course, it really doesn't impact you much, you know. It's the kind of thing you'll forget about in a few minutes. It'll just slip right out of your head. Because as you stop now, Robert, stop and think about, you know, going back and working with a tough client. Does it make you want to look at them and go, you're mine? Yeah, I don't know. We were just talking about, you know, they wouldn't give me a license to do therapy because I'm not qualified. I think that's wonderful. I didn't take all the right classes in college, you know. I have too many physical science classes to be a therapist. Not stuff which would be relative and useful in any way, shape, or form. You gonna live, Robert?
Yeah.
Pleasantly so, no doubt. Huh? But too much is not enough. I keep telling people that, and they won't listen to me. You know? See, you're... What's good is when you do that with clients, and they come in and they go, well, you know, I just, you know, I got out of hand, I yelled at my kids, I got in a big fight with my husband, and, you know, I feel like I'm just on the edge of divorce, and you go, what a stupid thing to do. You spend every day doing that? It's a lot of work. They don't even pay you for it. You know? Is it, what could you do that would put a smile on his face? Do you remember? Do you remember when you first got together and decided you'd actually like to marry this guy and live with him? Did you intend to make him feel like he hated you, or did you have other things on your mind that maybe slipped your mind in the past, but you'll begin to start to remember now just how pleasant those might be? Would you rather be doing those, or would you rather be fighting? It's up to you. And I always like it, because they always look at my empty hands like that. They always do that when I do it this way. I go, it's up to you, choose. They look at one hand, they look at the other like this. And you can anchor it visually, and they start looking at the one hand, and they kind of do this stuff, and I go, well, if you want it, take it. It's yours now! I love spatial anchoring. See, the thing is it's the degree to which at this point, because given all the other stuff we've been layering together, now's the point where you got to kick some shit. Because once you got the changes in people, they have the resources they need. Now you've got to punt them into the future. Because you got to understand, it's unfamiliar to them. And you got to make it so that they're now, the thought of going back is like, fuck that. You know, it's not like, oh, I have to avoid it. It's like, fuck that shit, you know. Give me some of that. And you got to put that in their mind, because you got to switch the focus of their attention to, I'm afraid I'll slip back, to, I don't want to go back. It has to seem like work to do that. I mean, it's like, you know, do you want to go back to the way you were? All I got to do is fire this anchor. See, it was just a demonstration. It really was. It's like, no, don't make me go back. Don't make me be the way I was. See, and what it does is it takes their attention off of it. Instead of being afraid of falling back into old patterns, their old patterns don't seem so good. They also, it makes their old patterns unfamiliar, which is one of the importance of the recode that you did. Since people opt for the familiar, what you want to do is to make it seem, what they were doing seem weird, seem uncomfortable, seem abnormal. Instead of, well, you're sure, you're used to it. It's like when they go, don't touch my knee, you know. It's like, because it's not like if they'll slip back into it. It's like, then they start thinking, he could really make me do this. And he would, too. I mean, my clients are, you know, I have clients that, they do this shit. They put one knee over the other one. And they go, don't be touching that knee. You finally got me the way I want to be. You just don't. And I go, oh, let me put it back. And they're going, no. And it's not that they think I can, and they know I would. You know, so I always tell them, look, I'm going to give you 2 pages of homework of ecstatic things to go out and do. If you do them, then I'll leave it there. If you don't, you know what will happen. Did you watch him flinch? That's the test. When you can get a flinch out of a client, say, I'll do anything. Because I like to give them a wealth of experience right out of the gate. I want to give them, you know, a list. And I do. I write out 2 or 3 pages, and it doesn't matter what you write. As long as it's stuff, you know, I always tell them, you know, that they have to go out and have fun this way and fun that way and fun this way and be nice to their wife, be nice to their kids, and do all these things, which are probably what they'd want to do anyway, but they weren't thinking about doing it because they were too consumed with some petty little bullshit problem. But if they'd rather spend their life thinking about it, no problem. This is the threaten your client phase, right? This is where, and it's not just a futile stage. It's the part where you behaviorally lock in, making it feel unfamiliar. It's no longer easy to go back the way they were. You know, it's not that they just don't want to. It's that it seems like so much trouble to live that way. So by making it unfamiliar. Now, the techniques, in case you didn't notice, involved in this, require, it's out of the meta model, it's called universal quantifier. Only this is behavioral universal quantifier. First, you set up diametrically opposed anchors, but you set them up in the context of really analogically doing an induction to make going back the way they were seem like such a pain in the ass. And you literally, since you have people in an altered state, they're in trance, you do a nice trance induction along with it. But you're doing an induction for unpleasantness, you know, about, and then you have to, and whatever it is, then you have to go and find ways around all those elevators, and you have to make all your meetings, you know, and think of every time you step on a flight of stairs where you can take an elevator, a little voice inside your head will go, I'm such a jerk, I'm such a jerk, I'm such a jerk, this is so stupid, I hate doing this. And every step becomes twice as high, twice as bad, right? Because the thing is this is the point where you, that's what clients do too, you know. They start cracking up. And when I can get them to laugh about the stupid way they've been living their life, can you imagine what I did to this guy about eating lunch at the bottom of his car? I want you just to let your fantasy run away with that one, right? I mean, he came in telling me this real sincerely, and I'm going, right, you lay on the floor of your car and eat your lunch. And I thought, I'm going to have a field day with this one. Ooh, in about 40 minutes, this guy's going to be rolling on the floor. He's telling me this in all seriousness now. 40 minutes from now, I'm going to be telling him the same thing, and he's going to be laughing like you'd have to be a jerk to do that. But, I mean, I hear those things in the beginning, and I file them away because I know I'm going to slam people right over the head with them later on. And it's not that I just enjoy slamming them, which I have to admit I do. That's just a fringe benefit. It's the fact that I can, by the time I'm done fixing it, so they know they don't have to live that way, when I start insisting that they have to, that if they don't go out and live the rest of their life, then suddenly this is going to slip back. Only now, when they get on the floor of the car, they're going to have to kiss the carpet. They're going to have to eat their lunch off the floorboards. And every bite they take, they're going to go, this is the stupidest thing a human has ever done. And I go, can you hear yourself say that to yourself? Now! You know. It's like this. Here, you want a sandwich? Have some food. You know, this is the kind of thing that, yum! It's like, you know. As a matter of fact, you know, instead of hanging your coat up when you go to work, you should put your coat at the desk and you go in the closet. You know, and while you're in there, and if somebody opens the closet, goes, what are you doing in here? Just tell them you're a jerk. Say, I'm planning to live the rest of my life. In fact, as soon as I retire, I'm going to go ahead and go to the mortuary and get myself a nice little 10x10 condo and move in ahead of time. What the hell? I mean, that way at least you won't be afraid of nothing. Except maybe suffocation. Ever felt suffocated? Can you feel this? You know. I said, you want to be an agoraphobic? Let's take it to the limits. You know. It's at that point, by being able to exaggerate things to absurdity, what happens is you're building in, and because what happens when they try to engage in the behavior, it doesn't feel familiar. Now it feels absurd. And this is one of the things about getting people to laugh about what they've been doing. You know, it's like taking a client seriously, feeling their pain, you know. I always go, what are you going to do if the client shoots himself? Have your brains blow out? You know, I mean, I know people that just about empathize that bad. Their clients get stomach aches, they get stomach aches. You know, I'm the kind of client that would go out and eat a handful of jalapenos chilies before I came in to see you. Hi! Ooh! That hurts, doesn't it? You know. I'd be the kind of client that go like this, you know, see if I can beat you up, but, you know, don't move or I'll shoot myself. I mean, that kind of way of dealing with clients so that you can get people. I mean, even in the context we're doing here, it's like, don't use that technique. Who knows? It might work. You might feel good about yourself. You might enjoy life, become enthusiastic. Your whole life might blossom. That'd be the shits, wouldn't it? That by taking that form of exaggeration where you take things to the limits of absurdity, absolute limits of authority. Number one, it makes your work a lot more fun. Trust me. Because, I mean, when you can get your clients to start to laugh, because one of my goals is not just to get them to laugh, it's a way of making it unfamiliar to them. So it just doesn't fit that they would do it. And I love threatening to make them go back the same way. Because the fact that they know I can do it and that I will, you know, when I look at them, they know. Because if they even hesitate, I'll do it. And I put them back, and then they go, oh, God. But then I, of course, whack them back the other way. And then I go, now choose. Which state do you want to be in? Because they're doing that anyway in their life, and they don't realize it. By focusing in on how little pain or how much discomfort or how you know, you ask people, you go, how are things going with your wife? And they go, well, not too bad. I mean, what kind of statement is that? You know, and instead of going, well, 90% ecstasy, you know, they're going, well, it's not as bad as it was the week before. Maybe next week will be worse or not as bad. But see, the Macs, they can, what the hell that's about, you know? See, to them, they take nothing to bad down. That's the whole continuum. They don't have good on the continuum. They're taking ground zero and looking to see how bad things are. Whereas if you can focus their attention to see how good things are, pick the best thing. And going back and recoding, looking for just the good moments, if they're too and few between, then maybe you don't deserve them. Then I start in on that routine because I go, well, look, you know, you lived for 20 years without a lot of pleasure. There's one of two things. Either it's your turn or you just don't deserve it and we should wipe it out entirely. Which do you think? That's one of the things I love about being able to see. See, because when I see clients, you know, I don't sit at a nice desk. Because the nice thing about, you know how pictures move closer and closer? And when you make people have choice and you start walking at them, when they start moving that one knee away, it's a kind of a decision, you know? You know, if they start sticking up the pain knee, hit it. Only amplify it even more and go back and start over again. Because what you want to do is to get them to the point where it just seems absurd and unfamiliar. Because what you're trying to do is to switch the perceptual grid by using the fluctuation of going back, going forward, going back, going forward. And by doing that oscillation between those two, what happens is you're trying to create making their old state unfamiliar. You're trying to, so when you have them go back, you're cracking jokes about it, about how stupidity, how ludicrous it is. But you must want it because you've lived that way. And probably it was best for you. All clients know it's best for them, right? And since you were fucked up for years, you should say, I fucked up 4 years more. This is where you begin to throw the logic they threw at you because they go, well, you know, I don't know if anybody can help me and I've been this way for years, so I'll probably be this way forever. When you throw it back at them at the end of the session, they're going, no, it doesn't mean that. Don't hurt me. Because what you're trying to do is really switch now at this point their perceptual grid. And the kind of trance that I did with him, and then after the trance, then I do it behaviorally. Because you also want to remember things are state conditioned. We want to pull it into the land of a different kind of absurdity. You want to take them all the way down, bring them all the way up, and then exhilarate them all with a forward focus. Because this means as they go back into their life and begin to fluctuate through states, it's still all going to be aimed forward. It's a kind of reframing that has to be done in multiple states. I was speaking to somebody earlier, and he's got a client. He fixed an agoraphobic, but they're still hooked on Xanax. And it's a drug. It's a good drug, too, by the way. For those of you who ever feel bad, take a Xanax. You feel great. Right. And then after that, all you have to do is do drug of choice. It's cheaper. But the thing is like the person is afraid that if they stop taking Xanax, they'll go back into agoraphobia. Now, it's possible that that will actually happen because he fixed her on the drug. So as you begin to decrease the drug, see, like what I told him to do is I said, go in and fix her once more. Right? Only this time tape it and then have her decrease the dosage and listen to the tape over and over again. Now, that's kind of a one way of doing it. And when you do it with drugs, it's something that's just time expedient to do it that way. But when you're dealing with the kind of stuff we're dealing with, one of the things you want to do is to make sure you do things through multiple states. Through states where, you know, because, I mean, sure, you come to work tired. So you want to trance them out and talk about how heavy things are, create that negative anchor, and then juxtapose it with the strong anchor. This is why I'm building a scale, and I'm going to flop it back and forth. Aim it as a choice and make the stuff going backwards seem real stupid and real unfamiliar. Because I'm trying to create now, more than just with the technology, but behaviorally, the set of submodalities that constitutes that just ain't me anymore. And you know that there are things that happened, things that you believed and did when you were a teenager that you cannot believe you did. You know it was you now intellectually, but you can't believe that you really did those things. You guys remember being a teenager? Right? Some of the things like, you know, I mean, you remember when you were a teenager, you were saying things like, well, I'll never have sex if I'm unmarried. Right, unless you're given a chance. Yeah, you sure won't be 40 and divorced saying that, I'll tell you that. You know, it sort of changes your attitude. When you think that you really believed that then, you know it was you, and you know maybe it made sense then, but it sure don't feel like you. It feels unfamiliar. It wouldn't be familiar to pop back into that way of being. Some of us, when we were teenagers, thought we were immortal. We thought we could make cars fly and couldn't get hurt. Stuff like that, right? When you think about it now, you go, eh, I don't think I want to try that, you know. It's like, you know, you can get back in the old car, but that foot don't go to the metal like it used to with wanted abandonment. But, of course, you end up with more body parts that way, at least I do. I have my share of pins, you know, pin in my knee and a few plastic joints and stuff. Those, you know, and the thing, you know, the thing they don't tell you about when you're a teenager, I found out one of the ways of working with teenagers is I do time distortion into the future. I have them wake up and get out of bed and have that knee hurt, that old bruise ache, and stand up and hear their bones crack because they did stupid shit when they were a teenager. So, because I know, because I have those experiences. You have to get up in the morning and make your leg work, right? It takes you 15 minutes to get your leg to work in the morning because you did this stupid shit when you were a teenager. You know, it'd be one thing if you just broke it and it got fixed, but it doesn't work that way. It hurts forever, right? It's like your body's way of saying, you know, it's like, don't ever try that shit again. Now, the thing is you want I can tell, I can tell that some of us in here know exactly what I'm talking about to more or less degrees. The thing is that you want to build the same kind of thing in. Now, there's an exercise, I don't know if we did it in the workshops you were in, where you literally go and find something, and you go and you find the submodalities of something that was like that, and you put things in it so it doesn't seem like you anymore. Well, that's all well and nice. You can do that during the session. But what I'm talking about is where they have no choice but to put it in those submodalities, but at every level, consciously, unconsciously, and with every fiber of their soul. And you don't get that by having people go inside and look at submodalities and do subtle changes. You get that through wanted and unadulterated output, where it is high-intensity drama. That the kind of thing that I was doing with Robert here by way of demonstration was to show you that you can affect every fiber of a person and bring it through various states, so that it doesn't just happen in trance, it happens through trance and all the way out to the highest exhilarated state, so that when you move towards them, they flinch, you know. And it's all about, are you going to look there or are you going to look forward? Now, of course, if you're real sneaky about this, the one thing that you do is that you make it so that, which knee do you anchor on? See, you want to make it so that the past, the one they're pulling away from, right, if they look at that direction, they're looking into the future. And if they look in the other direction, it fires off the anchor for the future. Sneaky, huh?
Come again.
Think about which knee I anchored on. Remember, I tell you guys, I'm a tricky, sneaky devil. Right? And I think about what I'm doing. I am methodical. Okay, that, in other words, if somebody's timeline, if the future is going out this way, right? Okay, I anchor the negative shit over here, right? So that if they do look this way, they are looking into the future. The positive stuff about the future, I anchor over here so that if they look this way, they go into the future. And if they avoid this, they go into the future. So that they're stuck in the future no matter what. Because that's where I want it. They either go for the positive future responses or they go for the positive future responses. Which is it going to be? Choose, right? Now, being able to set things up at every level with presuppositions, with language patterns, with your tonality, with everything, so that I start out creating a dichotomy of are you going to go back or are you going to go forward, right? Ends up being are you going to go forward or are you going to go forward? Because if you're going back, when they look back, it doesn't seem like them. It seems so stupid, all they can do is laugh. I mean, think about going back, Robert. Think about going back and interacting with a client identically the same way, the same kind of context. Well, just no, do it anyway. Just go ahead and go ahead and run, go ahead and run through it. You know, imagine in what? Well, it doesn't feel good. Doesn't feel familiar. Felt familiar this morning. I'm sure. Just go ahead and do it anyway. Or I'll make it go back the way it was. Do you want to live that way or do you want to do it once? See, do you notice how I keep compressing it? And I do this with, I have clients that throw their hands up and just go, leave me alone! Don't, you know, because the thing is I keep making it. I keep forcing it because it's a metaphor for the real choice. Because that is what's going to happen. They are going to go back and live the same way. But if I could keep focusing it and exaggerating it into instances, to the point where they slam their attention forward and it seems like ridiculous. Why would I do that? You'd have to be an idiot to live that way. I mean, I've had clients say that to me and I go, yeah, you would, wouldn't you? And they go, yeah, I know I live that way, but I'm not going to do it anymore. And I go, wanna bet? You know, and the thing, and then when the hand comes out, they go, no, not unless you make me, you know. This is the kind of thing that you want where they know that they've cut loose of it. Because this is where you want to disassociate people from the familiarness, the kinesthetics that allow them to easily slip back into the old way of being. just a suggestion, mind you. With that in mind, we'll stop for today.